surprised to hear Susan Falzone speak about Lafarge, the DEC, the EPA. Susan is the third speaker in our series on the environment called River Action, and today she's going to speak about Lafarge plant as a, in Ravenna as a jumping off point and as a way to discuss the interplay between industry and citizenry and how we can all kind of work together ideally to make this a better place to live, in a nutshell. Susan is a former management consultant who gave up that role to become involved in environmental issues, and she's the director, I believe, of Friends of Hudson. We have other luminaries from Friends of Hudson here as well. And she's been spearheading, along with CASE, another sort of grassroots organization in Ravenna, the attempt to kind of get Lafarge, the EPA, and the DEC to do the right thing by us. So she's going to explain the whole story. This probably all sounds very mysterious. And
yeah, it was more mysterious.
And we were so, if you were here before the first installment, you know that, that the workings between, for instance, GE and the EPA and the DEC are equally intriguing, to say the least. So, anyway, without further ado, Susan Falzone.
Thank you very much. I do have a slide presentation, but I want to encourage all of you to make this as interactive as you want it to be. This is just a structure for us as we go through this discussion. I'll probably talk for about an hour, and then we can have a really open discussion as well. The title of this talk is Industry in Our Midst. And it starts with the assumption that in the 21st century, in America, and in fact throughout the world, industry is in our midst, and for most of us, we wouldn't want it any other way or couldn't have it any other way. So we're starting with the assumption that it's here, or more is coming under certain circumstances, and we need to understand our role as residents, as citizens, in holding our government and corporations accountable for how they behave in our midst. Nina said I was going to speak about Lafarge, and indeed I will, but I'm going to start with a much broader context, a much larger context, because the circumstances surrounding Lafarge and the issues that present themselves to us today are very much the same as the circumstances that we encounter in many other places. So take a little trip with me to a broader landscape, if you will, and let's talk about the rest of the world for a bit. This is a picture of the BP Texas City oil refinery after it exploded in 2005. I won't say too much more about it. Many people were killed in this explosion, and subsequent to it, BP was sued for excessive benzene emissions. Many people in the area got pretty sick on breathing benzene and other toxic air emissions. Gotta press the right button, you know?
Were they successful suits?
I think they're still ongoing. This is something closer to us in time. The explosion this spring at the Upper Big Branch Mine in West Virginia. Can you see? At the Upper Big Branch Mine in West Virginia that killed 29 people and shut down that mine for a long time due to excessive methane release in the mine. I don't know about you all, but when I started watching the news on this one, it had me pretty horrified because these mine explosions happen with some frequency and have been for decades. And here we are, you know, 2010, and it's still happening. Just recently, a Connecticut power plant had a fatal blast and suffered or incurred $16.6 million in fines. Also, for equipment failure and shoddy workmanship. Am I getting all depressed enough yet? Because here's the big one. Who knows how long we will be living with the results of what happened in the Gulf of Mexico when the BP oil rig exploded. All right. What does this all have to do with our topic, which is industry in our midst? I purposely chose relatively recent examples and ones that affect us all. I didn't choose Bhopal in India. I didn't choose the Exxon Valdez, which was some time ago. I tried to pick examples of things that have happened in the past couple of years that have some currency and that have some impact on us. So my question to you all is, what do all those incidents have in common? This is the funniest participation. Well, no, the Connecticut Power Plant is not BP, but there are two that do have BP in common. Any other?
Human error.
Human error, exactly.
Negligence.
Some negligence, right.
The gases that are emitted, the methane.
The toxins and the gases, the volatile gases that are emitted, all of those they have in common. When I think of what they have in common, I'm drawn to slightly other kinds of thoughts. Not that I expected those to be yours, but I think about that all were operating legally. They all have federal and state and local permits. So their operations, until certain incidents, were sanctioned and approved by the government regulatory agencies. They were operating within the context of the laws that govern all of them. Sorry, I lost my pointer. You can't find your pointer, you can't do this.
Where?
It's on the screen.
On the left, on the upper left. On the side.
Don't worry. I just want you to be able to see this. They also had favorable status in their local communities. They provided jobs and other economic benefits, and there was little or no local opposition to the operation of these plants. When I heard wives talking at the Massey, outside the Massey Mine, and I heard reporters say to them, "Well, do you think differently now about the Massey Corporation?" I heard wives with husbands down in that mine, or who had just escaped from the mine, who basically said, "No, this is a company that provides jobs and puts food on our table." And that's just a fact of life when big industries operate in our communities. They all were discovered to have had poor performance, poor practices, and serious violations after the fact. That is, government agency records were uncovered, the press starts reporting about all of the violations that they had prior to the accident that got them on the front page. And in some cases, and we saw this particularly with BP, both in Texas and in the Gulf, the company attempted to avoid or minimize responsibility and reparations. They tried to minimize the amount of responsibility they will take and also what they will pay back for the privilege of operating in those communities. And that's a point that I want to come back to as we go forward, that these companies and others like them are operating according to the standards of our society. We are a society that encourages industry, that encourages corporations to provide, in many cases, what we consider for our public needs. But they also are operating in places where we live and where we need to start thinking about the fact that we are granting them the privilege of being in our communities. In my opinion, there needs to be a lot more give and take between the communities in which they operate and the companies themselves, and that will be a theme that we'll come back to. I'm going to move now to a couple of local companies, ones with which I'm familiar, and one is Lafarge, and the other one is Wholesome, formerly St. Lawrence Cement, that continues to operate in Catskill and Smith's Landing. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some recent history of violations, etc., with those two companies. But I'll start by going back to what do they all have in common. And Wholesome SLC and Lafarge have in common everything that those companies had in common. They're operating with legal permits. They are welcome in the communities in which they operate. I don't want to say after the fact here because we haven't had yet, and may we never have, fatal accidents. But they all have shown themselves to have poor practices and violations, and in some cases have attempted to avoid responsibility. So, in 2003, Lafarge applied for a permit to the state to burn tires as fuel in place of, or in addition to, the coal that they burn. And during that time, Frank Hudson, which was then involved with the St. Lawrence cement issue, also took a look, because it's a cement plant, also took a look at this tire burning permit. During the course of it, in our research, we uncovered what we consider to be a track record of serious non-compliance with federal requirements. I'm not going to go into this chart in detail. It's just to show you that we have the data. The compliance period started with the reports that we had in April 2001 and ended in June 2004. Deviations are non-compliance or exceedance from the levels they're permitted to emit, etc. And you can see that there were 44 incidents of opacity per six-month period in this time frame. Opacity is a surrogate for particulate matter, which is a surrogate for heavy metal emissions. So when they measured opacity, and they exceeded opacity an average of 44 times in any six-month period, they were putting more heavy metals into the air than they were permitted to put into the air. That's essentially the gist of this chart. Now, the probable cause of all these errors were human error, somebody said that here earlier, and equipment malfunction, 50 equipment malfunctions per six-month period for their exceedances. So, we brought this to the attention. Yes?
Why is the opacity trend going so high and not stopping going up?
Say that again?
Why do the opacity deviations keep going higher and higher?
Why do the opacity deviations go higher and higher? That's a good question, and I don't know. I don't have the data in front of me. It could be a function of increased production, but it's not likely. It's more likely that it's a function of human error and equipment malfunctions. And in fact, when we brought this to the attention of the DEC, I won't go into all the details of what happened, but basically, Lafarge committed to doing better operator training as far as opacity is concerned. So it's my expectation, without the data, the full data in front of me, that that's the reason.
Susan?
Yes?
I'm not sure that everybody knows where Lafarge is.
Oh. Does everybody know where Lafarge is? Aha! Lafarge is in Ravenna.
which is just north of Greene County. It's in southern Albany County. It's basically right over the line from New Baltimore. If you drive up 9W, thank you. If you drive up 9W, you pass the Lafarge plant. If you've driven up there, up 9W, you'll come to a point where there's a conveyor belt over 9W. On the left side is the Ravina Queeman Selkirk School District, middle school and high school, and on the right side is the Lafarge cement plant. If you drive up the thruway and you see a big plume of smoke on your left as you're going north, that's coming from Lafarge. And I'll go into a little bit more detail about the Lafarge plant. Why does it matter to those of us who perhaps live here and didn't know where it is? One, as the crow flies, it's not that far away. We don't know really fully how emissions are flowing. There's some question about what air patterns do here in this part of the Hudson Valley. That's one. Two, there are cement plants, and they're governed by regulations. You have two cement plants, basically, right on your river on either side. There's Germantown, Lehigh, and there's Wholesome Catskill. And they're all governed by the same regulations. Those are the reasons it matters to you specifically. Thanks, Nina. Okay. Here's one on SLC, which you all know is down at Smith's Landing. In 2006, I got a call from a riverkeeper. They have a boat that goes up and down the river, but they also have a plane that they take up from time to time. And lo and behold, when they flew over Smith's Landing, they saw a huge milky plume in the water extending from SLC's facility nearly a mile out into the river. It's an illegal discharge of wastewater into the Hudson River. It was a violation of the Federal Clean Air Act, and Friends of Hudson joined with Riverkeeper to file a Federal Clean Air Act lawsuit. SLC settled without taking responsibility exactly, but they agreed to take care of that outflow pipe. This was just in 2006. It's not just GE that destroyed this river. Now, this is Lafarge corporate nationwide. In 2010, the EPA, after investigation at several of Lafarge's 13 cement plants in the U.S., found significant violations of the Clean Air Act and related laws. You don't need to know these, but these are several federal regulations. The Clean Air Act, New Source Review, which is basically what's coming from new plants, emissions from new plants, and prevention of significant deterioration, which means you cannot pollute the air to the extent that air quality deteriorates any more than it already is. So the EPA found all of these violations, and as a result, they basically took Lafarge North America to court, and they got injunctive relief. Lafarge agreed to make several modifications to all 13 of their plants and do that by 2014. Now, some of the plants were not included in the initial study. So, for example, the Ravina plant, they didn't examine for violations. But what they said was they found enough violations in the plants that they did examine that all the entire Lafarge holdings within the U.S. had to be upgraded. They have a huge civil penalty of over $5 million. Some of it will be paid to the U.S., and some of it will be paid to the various state agencies that participated in the suit. New York State was one of them, and $490,000 has been awarded to New York State from Lafarge to fund environmental projects. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. That's the whole consent decree. It takes months for it to get signed. It was just recently signed by all the states, and it will go into effect very soon. So this is a local, relatively local plant. Wholesome, which is St. Lawrence of Cement, now formerly St. Lawrence Cement, now Wholesome, was recently fined by the Mine Safety and Health Administration, the same agency that oversees the West Virginia coal mines, with 300 plus violations.
Okay.
The fines are pretty large. Every article that you read about this stuff tells you this is the largest fine ever administered by this agency or that agency. These appear to be really large fines to us. These are simply rounding errors in corporate books. They are part of the cost of doing business. They know that these things will happen. Sometimes they cut corners as a risk. Sometimes corners are cut because they're not aware exactly. I'm not saying that they're always to blame. But the cutting corners and the cost that they have to pay to make up for that is part of the cost for them doing business.
That can be called licensing fees.
The licensing fees, exactly. I was thinking as I was driving here today, you know, what is the line item they have on their books? You know, is this held in reserve for fines? We know they fine the money, so they know they expect it. Okay. I'm going to talk now specifically about Lafarge and
Trina. Yes.
Come on. As I said, I wanted to put this in a broader context, and Nina very wisely reminded me to tell you where Avina is. That plant was built in the 1960s. It's about 47 or 48 years old now. It was first operated by Atlantic Cement and then by Blue Circle. And in fact, right before Blue Circle sold it to Lafarge, which is a French company, by the way, they have 13 plants in the U.S., but their headquarters are in France. Blue Circle was fined $276,000 in air violations. When Lafarge acquired it, as I showed you earlier, there continued to be compliance problems, and then they applied to burn tires. We were not successful in preventing them from getting a tire burning permit, but it brought to the attention of the DEC and the public that Lafarge needed to modernize its plant in order to meet impending environmental emissions regulations, including, we brought up the topic, the subject of mercury emissions at the time. At that time, and actually maybe until tomorrow, if we're lucky, mercury was not regulated in cement plants. So all the while that mercury was being regulated as an emission from power plants, cement plants were able to emit mercury with impunity. We raised that issue to the state, and we said that even though federal law doesn't prevent it, you can prevent it. And the state said, well, yeah, we will. We won't do it now. We'll do it when we renew their federal air permit. Their federal air permit expired in 2006. They have been operating under an expired air permit since then, and that's perfectly legal. We'll see when that air permit becomes final. It's in its final stages right now. So presumably, from 2006 to 2010, they were operating under that antiquated permit. And the state promised that they would address mercury in that permit. They really haven't, but the reason for that is that federal laws are going to cover mercury, so they supersede the state permit. Lafarge also realized that not only would they not be able to meet coming environmental requirements, their operations were extremely inefficient and costly, being a almost 50-year-old plant, and they felt that they would not be able to remain competitive with this plant as it is, so they announced modernization plans. Their plan is to replace their two old kilns
with one new, more efficient one, and an accompanying new smokestack that will be significantly hundreds of feet higher than the existing one. They're not tearing it down and rebuilding a whole new plant. Their intent is to reuse and reconnect to whatever they can and just tear down what they are replacing. So we're in that process right now. The context changed for Lafarge and for all of us from 1960 to 2008 when they announced these modernization plans. First of all, there was a lack of public awareness of the emissions and the dangers up until around 2008. There was broad public and local government support. Lafarge is considered, it's like a company town, Lafarge is considered to be the biggest taxpayer, the biggest contributor to the school system. The high school that's right across from the plant was built on land that Lafarge donated for that purpose. I don't know where anybody's head was at when they thought the cheerleaders and the runners and the football team were going to be practicing right across the street from that smokestack, but they willingly accepted the land and built the school there. There was no local watchdog. I started going up to Ravina in 2003 when we started dealing with the tire burning issue, and it was very difficult to make any inroads to relationships with local people. And, it's no different than here, except there I wasn't local. I was from down here. And the federal and state agencies were quite unreceptive to any concerns. For example, the mercury rule that should be made final tomorrow by the EPA. For over 10 years, Earth Justice, a national environmental legal organization, along with several other local groups, including Friends of Hudson, was suing the EPA to limit mercury in the cement industry. And the EPA repeatedly lost in court, and yet they refused to put in a rule to limit cement. They were totally unreceptive. Only with the change of administration did everything turn around as far as the Portland cement industry was concerned. So it was not the 40 or so years, 40 some odd years, the environment, the local environment, the public environment was not conducive to anybody doing anything to prevent the violations and the poison that was coming from Lafarge. A new context emerged in 2008. We spent a lot of time raising the issue of mercury, and it was picked up by the Times Union. It was an article, a series of articles in the Times Union about the amount of mercury coming out of the Lafarge plant, and it raised awareness and got local citizens thinking. A quarter of a teaspoon of mercury is enough to pollute a 25-acre lake. 400 pounds of mercury a year were reported to be coming out of the Lafarge plant. There's a lot of quarter of a teaspoon in that. So people became alarmed. CASE was formed, Community Advocates for Safe Emissions, was formed in Ravina by young women who grew up in Ravina, who graduated from Ravina High School. One of them was raising her family in Ravina, and they got very concerned. They started to investigate, they started to beat the bushes, and they started to organize the local community. And then there were the new administrations in Washington and Albany that I've alluded to that have taken on these issues in a much bigger way, including the DEC, which was pushing for the modernization. This is a flowchart that I don't expect you to know or even be able to read. But it is the law act that governs all of the applications for major facilities in the state of New York. And it's called the State Environmental Quality Review. And there's a huge flowchart of steps that have to go
a company has to go through. And one of the things that they like to say about CEQA is that it encourages public participation. I had to tell you that while it may encourage public participation, it doesn't make it easy. But I'm just going to walk you through some of these steps so you know where we are. The first thing that happens is a company says, Lafarge says, we want to modernize. And the state says, this is the type of action that is likely to cause environmental impact, and therefore it has to go through the CEQA review. The company itself creates an environmental assessment form in which they predict what kind of impact this will have on the environment. The state doesn't do it. The state only accepts and approves it. So Lafarge says, well, this is going to have minimal effect. We're not changing very much. In fact, we're making it all cleaner. The next thing that happens is the state looks at that environmental assessment form. This is called the determination of significance of the action, and they decide whether, in fact, it will have a potentially negative environmental impact. If it will have a negative environmental impact, potentially, they issue what is called a positive declaration. It is a positive declaration of potential environmental impact, and then it has to go through a review. Lafarge has done a scope which says these are the issues we're going to look at in the environmental review. And the next thing that happens is they prepare, again, the company prepares a draft environmental impact statement. Okay, so have I bottomed your mind so far? If the draft environmental impact statement is accepted by the state as complete, it then gets issued to the public for review. The state receives public comment, decides whether or not to hold a public hearing, and I guarantee you there will be a public hearing in this case. And then a final determination is made. And the final environmental impact statement essentially leads to the permit. Rarely are they denied. All right, talk a little bit about the issues. For the community, the issues inside the CEQA process, because there are some issues that are outside the process, they include what you would expect, air emissions, dust, traffic, noise. In this case, environmental justice, which I won't go into in a lot of detail, but it has to do with economics, state of the residents of the surrounding community, and if they're being asked to bear an undue burden because industry is locating in this. And another issue in the CEQA process is the timetable. The timetable is controlled by both the DEC and the company. That is, the state, the DEC, waits for the submissions by the company, and then the company waits for the DEC response. That could take years. Lafarge has said they want to do this quickly. They need to do it quickly because of the rules that go into effect in 2013 and 2014, but we haven't seen a whole lot of movement in a very long time. Other issues for members of the community that are outside of the state approval process are the ongoing health and environmental effects. Anecdotally, in the community surrounding the Lafarge plant, there is a significant incidence of a number of illnesses. Significant, again, anecdotal reports of rare childhood cancers. A lot of adult cancers of rare varieties, significant respiratory illnesses, heart conditions, etc. The people who live right there are concerned about the health effects of this plant in the future, but they're also concerned about what has happened to their families and their community for the last almost 50 years. That's not covered by the state process. Other issues that engage the community, as I said, jobs and taxes and other contributions. Lafarge is basically known as the chief benefactor People care about that. People don't want their property taxes raised, etc. We've done some work that seems to show that it's not as significant as Lafarge and some of the local governments would have you think. But that's the general mythology around it. Proximity of the schools, I've already mentioned. And another one that looms large for all of us where cement plants are concerned is alternative fuels. Right now they burn coal. They have a permit to burn tires. They can burn a lot of different kinds of waste materials as alternative fuels if they get a permit for it. And when you ask them if they intend to, they will say, no, our permit is just for tires and coal. But in fact, at any point in time, they can apply for alternative fuels. And these are basically sanctioned by the regulatory agencies because otherwise these would be considered waste, and this is a way to reuse waste. It's waste to energy generation. So Lafarge has already told us they're going to want to burn milk cartons. The plastic milk cartons? I don't know what's in that plastic, but I know it can't be good. And that's one of the alternative fuels that they have suggested. So that's something else that concerns the community, and it's not something we can do anything about in the permitting process. Am I, anytime there's a question or a comment, bring it on, okay? Here's where we are in the CEQA process itself. As I said, they've got a positive declaration. They claim that they prepared an EIS. They've submitted it to the state. It was returned once. Last time I talked to the DEC had the EIS, and they were reviewing it. And I asked them, what's taking us so long? And they said, we want to be absolutely certain that it's absolutely perfect. I have my doubts about that, but as to why it's taking them so long, but that's what they said. And we have no time frame for when to expect it. There's a lot more to go, and the lengthier processes are coming up. They are getting their Title V air permit is being renewed. It's right now in its final stages, and it's probably a couple more weeks until it becomes finalized. We had some issues with the draft permit, and my understanding is the issues that we had still appear in the final permit, and it's now going to be up to us to decide what we want to do about that. Case has had some very interesting ongoing activities. You may have read, some of you, about Wardstone's testing up there. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that, but Wardstone had collected data from flora and fauna and
soil
samples, etc. None of that was ever made public, but it's my understanding that that data is now in the hands of state agencies, and it has been taken into account in the Department of Health study. Yeah.
Are you aware of what's going on up there?
What do you mean?
What's going on? The plant has already started building the new facility. Callahan has moved out. Do you know where the new facility is going?
Right.
What Callahan is? Right. What Wardstone has found for evidence and to go for is the dust, the raw dust from Callahan's operation. Callahan has to be out of there in a year. Callahan has already bought Matter Construction Company down on Route 81. They've already paved the road, and they're moving down here.
Jared, I have not been up there in quite a while. I was actually out of circulation for 5 months. This is really my first month out of my house. So I am not aware of that, but I guarantee you that we'll be going up there this week. Thank you. They can't legally build, so the question is, if they are building, what do we do about it? And what we do about it is getting a job.
Well, Callahan's already got 90% of what they need in there. They've already got stone tunnels over into the stone piles.
Right.
Right over there.
Right.
Well, they're going to do two things. But Callahan moving out there, that shoots Lloyd Stone's theory down about all the pollution in the school coming from more dust than Callahan's, okay? So that's moving out of the area. They're going to go to finish in that product with a vertical kill, and that's going to solve all the problems.
Well, what we hope is that it will be cleaner. It's not going to solve all the problems, as you know. The other thing that's very interesting that's been going on under Casey's auspices is that a doctor from the Harvard School of Public Health has started conducting studies in Ravenna. About a month or two ago, he had an open clinic where he collected hair and blood samples from anybody who wanted to give them, and those are being they were collected by technicians from UAlbany Medical Center, and they're being analyzed. And it is the first phase of a pilot that hopefully will lead to a very, very large study that will have repercussions not just at Ravenna, but for the cement industry around the country. That being a huge study will take some time, but it is underway. And by the way, was mightily resisted by the powers that be in the area of the RCS school district. They wanted to take samples at the school and they weren't permitted. I think they got permission, but it wasn't easy. The Department of Health has claimed that their methods are not standard. And what Harvard has said is, you're absolutely right, they're not. They're state of the art. We have equipment to test these samples that no one else has. But that brings up issues of what can be admitted in various courts or processes in New York State if they're not sanctioned processes by New York State. This is not a simple issue. The Department of Health, Case and Fritz Cutson has been working, we had been working with the Department of Health for many months, trying to get a public health study. Because basically what we said when we sat down with them is, we really are not only concerned by what your study protocols have to be, we're not concerned about what your politics have to be. The people of Ravenna want to know what is making them sick. And that's what we want to find out from this public health study. Well, you know, that's a great objective, but that isn't how bureaucracies work. In any event, they have completed phase one of their study, and it's our understanding that they have found enough of significance. The phase one of their study is exposure. Is there enough exposure in the area for us to look further? It's our understanding that they have concluded that there is significant exposure, so they are going to go on to phase two of the study. We met with them about a month ago, and they're basically saying at the end of the summer, they'll be able to hold public meetings and announce their findings and announce what else they will be doing. Also, at the end of the summer, NYSERDA, who's responsible for administering that $490,000 penalty for New York State, is going to be holding a public meeting to describe what projects it will fund with that $490,000. And we spent a bit of time with NYSERDA and the DEC basically insisting that that money go to Ravenna and surrounding communities and not somewhere like Buffalo or Long Island. Just to make the whole state better, we said Ravenna has suffered enough. Put that money in Ravenna. So we'll see what happens. Okay. Now we come to the heart of the matter. And that is why community involvement and community awareness is so important. First of all, the government agencies either can't or won't guarantee the highest levels of scrutiny and analysis, monitoring, and enforcing. So when we found violations at Lafarge, the DEC did nothing. And it happens more often if you look back at the BP oil spill, you look back at the Connecticut power plant. Look at those four examples we had in the beginning. those companies were all cited for violations prior to the drastic catastrophes that happened there. Budgets, you know, obviously we don't even need to talk about budgets. Resources are very scarce at the state level. There's an administration bias sometimes. I don't know what the bias is, for example, but there's an issue of burning fly ash, adding fly ash to the cement process at Ravenna. The state DEC determined that they were going to prevent fly ash from being used in the process at Ravenna. The legislature held hearings on it. It's been recommended. It should have happened a long time ago, and it's sitting on the governor's desk, and he doesn't sign it.
Can you tell people what fly ash is?
Yeah, fly ash is...
flies.
It's not flies. It's what's left after coal is burned and contains basically... it's coal ash. It contains basically a heavy concentration of toxins. Why fly ash is being used at cement plants is because when the government came down hard on the power plant industry to limit their mercury emissions, they put in controls that prevented emissions from going up into the air, but concentrated them in the fly ash. That fly ash is potentially a waste product, a hazardous waste product, but the laws allow the state, or the federal government, the state, to consider fly ash to be a beneficial use if it is added to the cement process. In other words, it gets gotten rid of in the cement process, but it increases mercury emissions. That's sort of a simple and maybe not too technically chemical explanation. We heard this with BP, but it's not, yes?
Just a quick additional question about why actually. So if it's added to cement and found up in cement, is it a toxic, you know, is it out of that cement that's supposed to send up?
Yeah, it increases mercury emissions. It's added, it's used because it contains aluminum, which is which the cement making process needs, and it's much more abundant than other sources of aluminum.
So how does it get? Maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Cement is cooked at very high temperature.
It heats up.
It gets into the it is emitted as in mercury.
But once it's on the cement, and the cement is poured, does it leach out into the ground? Because cement is porous.
I don't know the answer to that, whether it leaches out. I don't think that's the significant problem with it. But you remember that sludge in Tennessee, that sludge pile that exploded essentially and flooded the area? That was coal ash. Jerry?
Now remember how much fly ash is in the air at the cement plant. The biggest part of that cement is going to the New York City number 3 water tunnel.
Right.
The contractors pouring that water tunnel can add some ridiculous amount of additional fly ash. Fly ash comes into that cement, and the water that goes through that water tunnel is high
in the
gases. It reaches out.
Right, it reaches out, but that's different than when it's in the process itself. When it's added to the end product, it's different, right? And it does reach out in that circumstance. Okay, the revolving door. We know, we've heard about that revolving door between industry and the government, and you know, it's understandable. It shouldn't be thought of as evil, I suppose. Maybe it should be better regulated. Those are the people who have the expertise. The way that they move from industry to the government and back, and the roles that they play when they move back and forth are a problem. They're a problem at the federal level as well as the state level. You know, then there's the bureaucracy. And then rules and procedures. There are rules and procedures that govern government actions that don't necessarily govern other people's actions. So, for example, the Department of Health can't take the findings from Michael Banks' Harvard study because that's not an approved protocol. Doesn't mean it's a bad protocol, it means it's not approved. So there are some limits to why government can't or won't do the job we think they ought to be doing. And then industry has a big leg up on all of us, my friends. They have the money, they have the expertise, they have the time, they have the strategic commitment. That is, they have a strong strategic investment in getting a plant up and running. They also have had this as a strategy long before we found out about it. In other words, their plans for building that plant happened somewhere in their corporate headquarters long before it became public knowledge to us. So they've done a lot of upfront work that most of us don't know about.
Can I ask you, what kind of economic benefits are there from these plants, from a plant like LaFarge? How many people do they employ, and what kind of tax dollars do they
have? It's a couple of hundred people that they employ. I'm sorry that I don't have the exact figures for the tax dollars here with me and not in my head, but they seem significant. But when you break it down to if they didn't exist there and didn't pay any taxes, how much people's property taxes would rise is insignificant, spread across the whole population.
So we should feel grateful.
Right. They also have implied and explicit threats. If we don't get our way, we're leaving. Well, in something like a cement plant, they're not going anywhere because they can't take the raw material with them. If they leave, somebody else is going to get dollar signs in their eyeballs and come and, you know, want to buy it. So the implied threat that if you don't give us what we want, we're leaving, is really ridiculous on the face of it. If there's 50 to 100 more years of raw material in them hills, they ain't going anywhere, and if they do, you can be sure there's someone coming right behind them. They have an enormous PR engine that we don't even think about until we're faced with the issue of having to counter some of the stories that they tell. For example, every time LaFarge was challenged about their 400 pounds of mercury, they said, we meet all federal and state requirements. Well, we don't know that, except there's no requirement at even federal and state level to limit mercury. But that kind of PR voice silences concerns. And they also, of course, employ major lobbyists at all levels of the government. They're lobbying the town board, they're lobbying the governor, they're lobbying the EPA, they're lobbying our senators and our congresspeople, and they're using top-level lobbyists at every level. So they have a leg up, and that's why, for all of those reasons, that's why our involvement as a community is important. It's important for us to be able to level the playing field. It's important for us to participate in all the processes, both the formal and the informal. They pay lobbyists, but we can call on our elected representatives and have meetings with them and create opportunities for dialogue and influence. We can create broader public participation. And very, very, very important, we have to remain watchful before permits are granted, because once the permits are granted, as we said, they operate within the rights of the law, no matter how toxic they are in our communities, and hopefully before violations occur and disaster strikes as well. And, you know, not everybody has to take the same level of participation. You all are here on Sunday afternoon, and I very much appreciate that. And I'm here on Sunday afternoon, you know. Who knows where we're going to be on Wednesday night, you know. But there's always something to do. And we're not asking everybody to take the same level of activity, but just basically to stay informed, to stay organized, to be ready for when these things come flying at us in our communities. And there are a lot of ways to do that. What's missing that we need to create in order to be able to remain active. We need to create broad local community consensus and also ownership and stewardship of our towns, our villages, our regions. As I said, this is our home. They are guests in it. They call us host communities. They need to behave the way we expect well-behaved guests to behave. And we have rights to ask them for certain behavior because this is our home. They're just visiting. And I mean, I can't stress that enough. We're big on local ownership, property rights state. Well, you know, where are our rights, not just with our neighbors, but where are our rights where these multinational corporations are concerned? We need to spread regional awareness. The people in Ravenna are laboring by themselves. I'm in Catskill. How many miles is it? 30? I don't know. Maybe 30? They need help. They need support from people outside of their immediate jurisdictional district. And we need to create cooperation and partnerships with our local governments. The time for us and them is long over. And we've seen a number of examples where the us's and them's can get together and talk prior to various impending actions or activities, that people build relationships, build relationships with their town governance, build relationships with the people in the town government, build relationships with your state representatives. It starts and ends with relationships, in my opinion. All the rest of it we can work to get, the expertise, the money to fight these battles, etc. But if you start out opposing or being concerned about a plant like Lafarge, and you have no relationship with your local government, you're already in a pitched battle. And the state government will say to you, well, what does your local government think? Well, what does your local government think? It thinks what your neighbors think. And if you and your neighbors aren't thinking much about it, they're not thinking much about it either, except the revenue. So it's relationship building. It's starting with building trust, with communicating, and working those relationships. And sometimes it isn't fun. But it's work that needs to be done.
I was going to say that also, just quite aside from government stuff, there's just that within the community, the relationships are usually so fraught. You've got people, you know, in a company town, you've got people that have operated and worked in these factories forever. So I'm fine, I've worked there for 50 years, nothing's wrong with me.
Yeah,
I mean, right. And in some cases, there isn't anything wrong with anybody, but just forging some kind of...
Absolutely, I think it starts with talking to each other. I mean, everybody here, if you have some concern about what I've talked about today, don't just talk to your spouse or your partner, talk to your neighbors. People like me, we'll come to anybody's house and talk to three people. There's a lot of ways to spread the information and raise the awareness.
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to what you just said, because I happen to spend a lot of time in Ravenna, and I know a lot of people in Ravenna, and I go to many meetings in Ravenna because I cover the area. And frankly, I don't find that people are, in general, worried as you are.
Yes.
And they don't think that they should be worried, and they're not, you know, feeling like they're missing anything that they can't solve in their community. And so, even though I know some people who are, you know, obviously very supportive of certain things that are going on, there are many that are not, absolutely, and that needs to be stated. And I just have one question about
the DEC responded to this summary, which I read through, and one of their responses was to the fact that Case had submitted 47 soil samples and claimed a certain level of mercury, and they were received after the deadline. So the DEC said that they were not able to completely respond to it. However, they did go on to say in response to this summary that the level of 400 parts per billion, which were cited in soil samples, is within the level of 800 parts per billion, which the DEC currently says is their level.
Okay.
Right. So I'm just a little curious about, I mean, yes, Case did do some sampling, but evidently you said that they now have the results of, because they didn't have any results, they said in response to the summary, which was just issued. So you said earlier that they now do have the results.
The Department of Health has the data, Wordstone's data, according to people in the Department of Health. So if they have it, that means the DEC gave it to them, that means the DEC has it. And he raised a very important point. There's a comment period. The comment period ends, and somebody submits something after the comment period. I talked about regulations and procedures. The state is not required to take that into account. We can make a lot of noise about it, we can sue about it, we can try to get them to reopen, but when they say the comment period ends on June 1st, anything that comes in after June 1st might as well not happen, as far as they're concerned. Those who need to sit down and buy. Now, you know, again, I don't expect everybody in the community to know and understand that. That's what organizations like Friends of Hudson are here for. To basically guide and enable people who want to participate in the process through the process. Also, you say that it's within the acceptable limits.
That's what it says in the response to the summary.
Here's what we have to concern ourselves with as members of the public. Standards change, science and technology finds new information, and over time, standards change. Limits get raised or lowered according to the way conventional science and technology determines that they ought to be raised or lowered, and the law follows that. None of this is set in stone forever. It is the way it is today, and we can anticipate that some of those laws will change based on new standards. Right now, if we are to participate within the legal regulatory process, which is what allows or denies these things to exist, we have to either operate within those standards or prove that those standards are ineffective or inappropriate. But that happens outside of the regulatory process. That's changing the law, and that's a different thing.
And the type of change between Hudson and the New York City since the 78 cement plants operating in abandoned boroughs. Are they in the
same operating abandoned
and abandoned cement plants? When you take the train around the river, you see them. Are the other ones?
Right now, there are only three coal cement plants operating in New York State. Glens Falls, Lehigh, up in Glens Falls, Wholesome, Catskill, and Latoya Trevina.
Germantown
is not a Portland cement plant. It is another cement plant, but it's not a Portland cement plant.
When you say,
that's it.
When you say Germantown, are you using cement or
no? No, it's Wholesome plant in, did I say Germantown? It's in Catskill, Smith's Landing, I'm sorry.
Are the other plants in the same boat as Lafarge?
Lafarge is one of the largest cement plants in the country. It's definitely the largest in the state. It's one of the biggest. The Wholesome in Catskill does not compare, and Glens Falls and Lehigh is not as big.
But are the other ones having problems with their emissions?
Their technology is not as old. When you say, are they having problems?
Yes, their missions are.
Their missions are supposedly as they are regulated. So none of them had mercury limits and still don't until that law goes into effect. Hopefully that law will be announced tomorrow. If it is announced tomorrow, it's a rule actually, if it is announced tomorrow, companies will have until 2013 to come into compliance. And there are rules that are different for new plants and existing plants, but will basically lower emissions.
I guess that's now smart as an EPA rule, is that what you mean?
Yes. Yeah, it's an EPA rule under the Clean Air Act.
Another question. After the mercury comes to the emissions, okay, where does the sound? Does it end? Where does it end?
We can't directly answer that. We can't specifically answer that question now because no one has done any of the model for where those emissions are going to fall. That cement stack will be higher than the current one. Basically, it enters the worldwide global mercury stream. And while mercury does not affect our local, it doesn't fall directly here, but enters the worldwide stream, pollutes around the world.
And it's coming from elsewhere.
And it's coming from elsewhere as well. The Midwest power plants, New York State sued the Midwest power plants for mercury. It's a world, a global stream. The question is how much of it and what kind of mercury impacts us locally is a question we haven't answered yet. Lafarge would like to say none, but we're taking that with a grain of salt.
I had some mild logic questions, but I'm here for me here today. I'm just concerned about an article you read, it's on vacation, about the cement plant emissions contributing to the lung cancer. And what do you know about that? I don't know what article you read.
Particulate matter and heavy metals are carried in the particulate matter, which is essentially dust emissions from the cement plant, do get into our lungs. And, has anybody said directly and specifically what causes any one incidence of lung cancer? No. Correlation isn't necessarily causation, which is one of the biggest problems that we have in this field. Just because it can doesn't mean it did. But there's a very hard things to prove or even study. But are the emissions from cement plants considered to be putting people at risk for lung cancer and heart disease and other respiratory problems? Absolutely. Absolutely. That question, that's why they're regulated.
A few months back, it seems to me that there was some story of, didn't Lafarge say something about emitting, I'm probably making up these numbers, 150 pounds a year, and the EPA came back and said 184 would be permissible or something?
This is in the Title V air permit. The Title V air permit gives them permission to emit more mercury than they say they expect to emit. So the permits often give a potential to emit, and they can go up to that number, and they didn't set that number as low as what they claim their current projected emissions would be.
Which is crazy.
Any other questions? So, I have a question. This is about what we can do. And I don't want everybody walking out of here feeling like gloomy gusses. I'd like to open up the discussion a little bit to, and not very long, because I know it's hot and your cookie's waiting, but to what's new and different for you today from what we've talked about, and if you see any way for you yourselves to hook into any of the things that we've talked about in terms of citizen action. I don't make it easy. Alright, I'll suggest one. You all have neighbors. You heard this today. Start talking to your neighbors. You know, how many of my neighbors don't know that there's a cement plant 30 miles up the road? Talk to them. Check out, you know, websites like Casey's website and Friends of Hudson's website. If we ever fix the problem with it, that is out of our control at the moment.
And also that toxics website.
If you're really interested in toxics,
what's the name of that website?
I have to find it.
Yeah, well.
Walter
Hank. Yeah, Walter Hank, but
just a little Google him.
Google Walter Hank, thank you. Hank, H-A-N-G, isn't it?
Yeah.
Walter.
He's been doing a lot of work recently on hydrofracturing. But he's assembled a database on a lot of different emission problems. And he has a national reputation.
The thing that strikes me, and it was part of why we created this little series, is how nobody knows anything. It's there in the newspaper, whether it's local paper or not so local paper. And nobody, it doesn't seem to sink in. And it's very easy when things are kind of invisible. I mean, it's one thing to see the plant, but you can drive past it. But it's very easy to ignore. And it would be great if people would not ignore, become informed, and use that information. Write a letter, come to the meetings when we have public hearings and stuff.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
There'll be public hearings.
There have been.
What do you think is a big business? It's the same thing to frighten. What you read in the newspaper is over.
Right.
And there are many articles that reporters have written and couldn't get published.
Yeah, this is what we're doing today, so we hope to see you in the paper.
Yep.
And this, of course, is being recorded by WGXC, so it will also be on the internet on WGXC. Is it WGXC.org? Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer than we already have. Chris?
I have a suggestion as a citizen. I think if you have a chance to rent the movie The Cove, it's available as a DVD, and it has, it's a very interesting film about dolphin kills in Japan. But one of the major subtexts of that movie is really about mercury and how it is permeating the food chain. And one of the add-ons to the movie that you can see in the DVD version really goes into this whole question about the effect of mercury on human populations worldwide through the food chain, particularly through fish, and apex predator fish. And one of the disturbing things you learn from that is that the Atlantic tuna is even more high in mercury concentrations than those that are caught here in Japan, which indicates that there are risks of mercury emissions that are getting into the food chain from North America. And as soon as we talk about this global pattern. Anyway, it's disturbing, but I think also energizing too. I mean, it's just one of the issues that's coming to focus. I think Casey's been doing some really great work focusing on this locally. So there's a real evolution of awareness, and I think that this is something that will turn people around when they realize how real this issue is. So that's just a suggestion.
Thank you. Thank you all very much for Green Powers Place for having us and providing this opportunity for the